Time now is 8:06. We're listening to Local News Hour. Someone who's not confused is Cedric Haynes of the ABC 4 Weather Center, who's going to check in now with an update on what we can expect this weekend.
Good Friday morning, KPCW listeners. After a hot Thursday, we are looking at still a very warm first day of summer. Summer officially arrives at 8:42 tonight, the summer solstice. That means we're going to be looking at over 15 hours of daylight for us as we go throughout today. Your temperatures, they're going to respond to that daylight as we're looking at highs back into the mid-80s in Park City as we go throughout this afternoon. And high temperatures will climb into the upper 80s and lower 90s across the Heber Valley as we go through this afternoon with all that daylight. Again, we're looking at lots of sunshine out there, windy conditions as well. Those winds could gust up to 30 to 40 miles per hour at times throughout the day. You combine that with the dry fuels and the low humidity levels we have in place, and yes, that's going to give us a critical fire danger threat as we go throughout the rest of this afternoon. So make sure you're using extreme caution as we go throughout the rest of your Friday when it comes to any outside burning. In fact, avoid any outside burning at all costs. As we go into the weekend, we're going to see those similar conditions sticking around, but it gets much cooler across the area. We're talking temperatures starting off into the 40s here as we're going to your Saturday morning with highs on Saturday afternoon only in the mid-70s. Beautiful weather expected for Park City with highs only in the low to mid-80s in the Heber Valley with all that sunshine. So, again, a gorgeous start to the weekend, and it wraps up just as nice, if not even better, almost on the cool side. We're talking temperatures by Sunday morning in the mid-30s out there across the area from Park City down to the Heber Valley. Would not be surprised to see a few folks even flirting with the freezing mark come early Saturday or Sunday morning. Otherwise, Sunday afternoon, we're going to have lots of sunshine, but high temperatures struggling to get into the low to mid-60s for highs for Park City. Yeah, it's going to be a big cool down. And for the Heber Valley, we're going to struggle to hit 70 degrees by your Sunday afternoon. We stick with the chilly temperatures with lows down into the 30s again for your Monday morning. High temperatures back into the mid-70s in Park City and low 80s for the Heber Valley. That's a look at your latest forecast from the ABC Forecast Center. I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, I'll be speaking with Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune about Senator Mike Lee's recent tweets and changes in the level of civility here in Utah politics. Then Karen Locke will update us on new activities at the National Ability Center in Moab. We'll finish our hour by speaking with Angie Kell of the Glenwild Homeowners Association about the upcoming joint HOA Wildfire Preparedness Fair. Stay tuned. Well, Utah distance runners are going to need to pick the pace up a bit in order to qualify for the iconic Boston Marathon. KPCW's Grace Dorfler details the changes.
The Boston Athletic Association announced June 16th it's making changes to how runners can qualify for a spot in the world's oldest annual 26.2-mile race. It's already competitive for runners to reach the starting line. Boston hopefuls must race another marathon first and meet a time standard based on their age and gender. And in the latest update to the rules, runners seeking to Boston Qualify, or BQ, on a course that includes significant downhill sections will now need to complete those races 5 or 10 minutes faster than marathoners on mostly flat courses. The rules go into effect for the April 2027 race. The BAA says the changes to offset the advantage racers enjoy on downhill marathons. The Boston Globe reports nearly 10% of the competitors in the 2025 Boston Marathon qualified thanks to courses with at least 2,000 feet of net downhill. In Utah, marathoners and race organizers are paying attention, including Jordan Bird, the race operations manager for the St. George Marathon.
Obviously, it's tough because we're one of the original net downhill courses that was a Boston qualifier, but at the same time, understanding because of how popular racing marathons are becoming now, that it makes sense that a line had to be drawn somewhere.
The St. George Marathon is among several races in the Beehive State that pride themselves on courses designed for personal bests. That includes Revel Big Cottonwood, part of a race series that specifically bills itself as the place to BQ. The popular Deseret News Marathon in Utah County will be affected too, as will several smaller Utah races. Deseret News Marathon race director Corbin Talley said his course's net downhill is barely over the 3,000-foot mark, so next year organizers will consider moving the start line slightly down the road to save runners 5 minutes. Online, some runners celebrated the changes, with more than a little schadenfreude directed at Utahns and other downhill racers. RIP Utah Runfluencers, one commenter wrote on an Instagram account dedicated to running news. Some marathoners felt the time penalties should be even stricter. Bird, the St. George race organizer, says the Boston rule change is only a small piece of what the marathon is about.
Not everybody races to qualify. Some people just race just to race and just to have fun. And like I said, even just for those to get a PR.
He says he's confident the Southern Utah race will remain a favorite among distance runners, whether they're chasing a BQ or not. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
A Midway City Council vote is the last step to preserve part of the Pear Tree Llamas property as open space. Christine Weller has more.
The 37-acre Pear Tree Llamas Ranch in Heber Valley sits east of Center Street and south of Midway. Wood Robinson from Utah Open Lands said it's an important conservation property.
It hosts a number of scenic and agricultural characteristics that we think are fundamental to kind of the cultural fabric of Midway and the Heber Valley. We've also seen a silver fox on the property, which is just a unique type of red fox that is really quite stunning.
The property has a diverse ecosystem and also features pollinator-friendly plants and a range of birds, including ruffed grouse, sandhill cranes, and California quails and partridges. The land is worth $6.5 million. Property owners plan to provide a quarter of the value, around $1.6 million, to aid in its preservation. Robinson said Wasatch County has approved $750,000 of Wasatch Open Space Bond funds to preserve the property. The Midway City Council is considering providing the same amount.
A formal recommendation has been issued by the Midway Open Space Committee.
The City Council visited the site on June 13th and discussed the recommendation. It's unclear when the council will vote on the proposal. Federal and state funding would cover the rest of the cost, including money from the Larrae McAllister Fund, a program to preserve agricultural land in Utah, and the Federal Regional Conservation Partnership Program. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, Utah Senator Mike Lee has received a great deal of attention in recent days, stemming from some of his social media posts. Here to talk about Senator Lee's social media habit and how the degree of civility in Utah politics has evolved is longtime Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke. Welcome back to the program, Robert, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning. Happy to be here.
So let's first of all, for those who haven't been following the story closely, can you just briefly describe the recent posts the senator has made regarding the recent Minnesota shootings?
Yeah, it's your listeners probably know, Saturday, early morning hours, the two former lawmakers from Minnesota State House and their spouses were shot by an assailant. One of the couples died. Within a few hours of that, Senator Lee had started making posts on his X account about it. One of them was, you know, a picture, a ring camera image of the guy waiting on the doorstep to, you know, the guy that police believe was the shooter waiting on the doorstep. And the caption he put on it was, "This is what happens when Marxists don't get their way," insinuating that this guy was a Marxist, a leftist. And then he posted another picture of the guy and he said, "Nightmare on Waltz Street," which is Tim Walz, governor of Minnesota, former obviously vice presidential nominee, and people read these and a couple other posts he made and thought that they were making light of the shootings, which were politically motivated and also, you know, appear to have been perpetrated by somebody who was not a Democrat, not a leftist or Marxist, but somebody who was very much a Trump supporter and anti-abortion advocate and so forth. He had, when this guy was arrested, he had a kill list that had a number of other Democrats on it and pro-abortion figures. And so that created a lot of controversy.
And you posted a story yesterday about, you know, Lee's recent social media posting history. Frankly, if you'd shown me these posts 5 years ago, and I would have said, that can't be something done by a real U.S. senator. Talk a little bit about his posting history, because apparently extreme postings are not a new thing for Senator Lee.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think he created this Twitter account about 3 years ago. So this is something that is not brand new, but it's, you know, he's got a track record. Some of the stuff he's posted has been just flat out wrong, or, you know, very politically. He's a bulldog politically, let's put it that way. You know, he posted stuff that questioned whether there were federal agents in the who participated or led the January 6th insurrection. Posted an image of a guy holding, who said that this guy appears to be holding a badge, and it wasn't a badge. The guy had already been convicted and admitted to being in the insurrection. And so, you know, it's stuff like that. Stuff that the questions promotes these conspiracy theories about Jeffrey Epstein being murdered, and which, you know, he posted over 40 times about the Epstein, questioning whether Epstein committed suicide or whether he was killed. You know, and it's things like that. He reposted something about, you know, posted a fake news release, I guess, that had been circulating on social media about Jimmy Carter dying over a year before Jimmy Carter died, and it had some tasteless comments in the news release, and he didn't obviously do his homework and look at that. But and on top of that, you know, it's a lot of stuff about, you know, just he uses the platform to sort of promote his political agenda. You know, cutting funding to USAID and NPR and other things. He was very much involved in promoting the Doge movement and tweets at Elon Musk frequently. Like, he's really his most interacted with account over the last several months. So, you know, this is something that he does have a track record of using this account to kind of be edgy and, you know, something that's going to, in this social media world, you know, you've kind of got to be a Marjorie Taylor Greene or somebody like that to be an influencer, to get the attention. And he has really kind of stepped right into that role.
And back in April, you posted another story about just the volume of the tweets. I mean, and again, we can divide them into sort of what I would say traditional political issues-oriented advocacy and some of these stranger things, but how many tweets is he posting in the last couple of years?
Yeah, I was kind of blown away by it, to be honest. He had posted over the course of the first 90 days of the year over 90,000 tweets. So
I'm doing the math.
Yeah, it's. Did I say 90,000?
Yes.
9,000. I'm sorry.
Yes.
9,000. I'm sorry. So it was over 100 a day, which, you know, if you do the math, it works out to about every 15 minutes during the entire course of the first 3 months of the year. Some days there were even more than that. Some day his record setting day was, I believe, on March 10th of this year. Over 340 tweets in one day. And so that works out to about every 2.5 minutes he was tweeting, which is, you know, a lot, obviously. And it's a lot, especially when you think about, you know, he's a sitting U.S. senator and has a pretty important job that he's hired by the citizens of Utah to do. And so, you know, there are some, obviously some who are politically not aligned with him, but also some who are just kind of shocked by the volume and how much time, you know. A lot of the tweets, to be fair, are, you know, him saying retweets or things where somebody says, hey, totally agree, Mike, and he gives him a thumbs up or something like that. They don't take a lot of thought or time or whatever. But, you know, even that, if you're doing that every 2.5 minutes, it's like it adds up. And there are people who question, like, how is he doing this and trying to represent his constituents? And does one take time away from the other?
Now, I realize that the Tribune does not have people following him around all day, but is there any reason to believe that he's not, that he's just having a staffer do this, or do you think he's doing it himself?
Yeah, that's a good question. So he does have his official office Twitter account as well. This is he's got an account that pushes out press releases and things like that. Because it's kind of worth noting in this Minnesota example that we started the day with, he's posting these things on his based Mike Lee account. And there's also, you know, there was an official statement extending condolences and thoughts and prayers to the family and so forth on his official account, because those official accounts end up being a lot more you know, methodical, I guess, polished and calculated when they post things. This one, from people that I've talked to, you know, Mike Lee won't respond to questions about whether he's doing these posts himself. People I've talked to who worked, you know, in the Mike Lee world say that they believe he does it. But, you know, there's not been a response from anyone saying that he's paying somebody to do it or whatever. So it's a good question, you know, but it all indications are that he is doing these, managing this account himself.
It is going to make you wonder the next time you see him sitting in a Senate hearing and he's got his phone in his hands, what he's actually doing.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay, so I want to put this into a broader context. Robert, you've been around, you know, the Utah political arena for a long time. Take us back 15 or 20 years. Wasn't there a degree of civility in Utah politics that really seems to have deteriorated almost rather rapidly in the last 5 years or so?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the U.S. Senate especially used to be sort of a gentleman's club, you know, and it's the world's most deliberative body. You know, and we've seen that in the age of Trump politics, that's just kind of, he's sort of changed the way it's done. I mean, he was sort of one of the early adopters on, you know, Twitter, kind of made his reputation, and he still uses his Truth Social account to gain political influence, to, you know, to promote his political agenda. I think Senator Lee has kind of fallen squarely into that mold. And so now you've got he's got up over 600,000 followers, but you get those followers in the sort of the social media world by being the most edgy and the most controversial, or saying the most inflammatory and incendiary things, and so he's taken that Trump playbook and turned it into his own thing. Yeah, I mean, I think it does. What that also does, though, is you have to be the most extreme person on the right or the most extreme person on the left to really resonate with the base of the people you're trying to reach. And so you've got to be more and more provocative to break through sort of the social media din. And that results in this sort of caustic, toxic political dialogue that we've got, where these divisions are wide and you score points by attacking your enemies rather than, you know, having informed, thoughtful, deliberative policy debates. So, yeah, I think social media has damaged and undermined our political discourse. There's really no doubt about that, I don't think. And I think that, you know, Senator Lee has taken up one of the high profile roles in that corrosive political discourse that we have today.
Yeah, somehow I can't imagine either Senator Bennett or Senator Hatch, you know, engaging in this kind of sort of caustic behavior, conduct.
Yeah, it seems pretty unlikely that they would have done that. But, you know, there's a ton of people who do it. There's this whole, especially on the conservative side, this whole conservative social media influencer world that Mike Lee communicates with a lot of those people on his Twitter account. You know, you've got the Benny Johnsons of the world, Elon Musk, he interacts with all the time, and you know, it builds your clout, and that's one of the things that we should note, I guess, is that it does arguably elevate him, give him a little bit more political clout than a senator who doesn't do this, right? He can influence, he can shape the policy debates in Washington by mobilizing these 600,000 followers that he's got now.
And again, it's not just a phenomenon with Senator Lee, although this is probably the most noteworthy example. When I look at other kinds of Utah political battles, I look at the dialogue between Governor Cox and Phil Lyman. But again, that has had a caustic tone on both sides. And you know, Governor Cox promote this, what is it, argue better concept. But nonetheless, there was some caustic stuff that goes on between the two of them as well.
100%. I mean, it is, Phil has very much followed the Trump model. Phil, we know that he doesn't do all of those social media posts himself, but it wasn't just the social media posts. It's this attack, and really destroy your opponent. It's following the Trump model. He's seen Mike Lee do it, and it's worked well for him. And it's becoming a lot more common all across the political discourse that we've got. Social media, I think, has really kind of And another thing is, I guess, that the facts don't matter so much as the number of likes and retweets that you get. And so, yeah, it's interesting to see. And it's also, in Phil's case in particular, you don't need a lot of money to, you know, start making an impact, right? So whereas in the past, you got to run TV ads and send mailers and this traditional means that don't necessarily reach people. This is about talking specifically to people who already support you and getting them angry and energized and willing to do what you want. So, yeah, it's Trump's revolutionized our political discourse, especially on social media. And I think there's people have seen that it worked for him and are trying to model their own persona after that. And it does fly in the face of this disagree better mentality that Governor Cox has tried to promote. But it's pretty effective in some instances.
You know, if we go back in time, I mean, I think there certainly have been sort of controversial and, for lack of a better term, mudslinging Utah politics before. But I'm trying to think, you know, if we go back like 10 or 15 years, I think one of the Matheson's campaigns had some kind of, you know, angry accusations going back and forth. So it's not completely new. I guess what you're saying is that the degree of incivility that has always been there has been amplified greatly by the presence of social media then.
Yeah, I think the heat's been turned up. It also makes it really, I mean, social media is so much easier. I mean, if you don't have to cut a television ad and buy time on TV stations or, you know, radio stations, or, you know, you don't have to produce mailers and mail them out to people. It's just within seconds you can send this message out. And if it lands and goes viral, then, you know, that's a very effective means of communicating to a particular group of people. Obviously, you're only reaching, and that's another important reason why it is so caustic, why these messages have to be so provocative. And, you know, Jon Stewart called Mike Lee an edgelord, is because you're only communicating to a limited group of people. And so you've got to become trollish and then hope that somebody else picks it up and amplifies it. And that's another thing that the right's done very effectively. Like I said, Mike Lee, you know, interacting with Elon Musk has a massive following. And if you know, they amplify each other, but especially Elon amplifying Mike, and it creates this, it really helps you communicate effectively to a group of followers who already are pretty aligned with you to be following you anyway. And you can, you know, you can be as provocative and edgy and counterfactual and misrepresent the facts all you want. And usually that's a more effective way to, you know, break through the, and then it creates this echo chamber, right? The people who are on social media are usually following somebody that they agree with politically. You know, in some instances, obviously there are people who disagree and like to shout at the senator through their tweets. But you're really trying to just communicate in anger and agitate the base. And so, you know, you can really and then hopefully the other thing that we should note, I guess, is that Twitter also has started paying its content creators for their posts. They started doing that back in 2023. So it, potentially there is also financial motivation to produce tweets that are seen by as many people as possibly can be seen. And those are usually the tweets that are most inflammatory.
And to the extent that a sitting U.S. representative or senator is getting paid for tweets, is that something that would end up in their mandatory disclosures?
It is. It should. He has, for the 2024 year, that was his disclosure was due in May. And keep in mind, Twitter initiated this program in late 2023, so it didn't show up in his 2023 disclosure. But his 2024 one was due last month. He filed for an extension, so he's got, I believe, until September to turn that in. But, you know, and Twitter's not really transparent about how they calculate these payments. It's usually, it's kind of, in the past was done sort of based on how many clicks and or how many views and likes a tweet gets. Now it's more weighted toward how many influencers interact with you or how many of the premium account holders interact with you. So we should see those in a few months, but just sort of back of the napkin math, it could be tens of thousands of dollars that he's receiving from this social media account that he's got, that he does sort of as a side hustle, I guess you could say.
Okay. Robert Gerke, thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks. Right. Have a great day.
Well, many of us are familiar with the National Ability Center's locations at the Ranch campus and, of course, at the PCMR base. But now the NAC is expanding its operations in Moab. On the phone is Karen Locke. She's a senior program director for the NAC's Moab activities. Good morning, Karen. I hope we're not going to keep you from mountain biking too long this morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you doing? No, it's all good. It's hot down here right now.
Okay.
We're getting on the water today.
Getting on the water. We're going to talk about all the different things you guys do down there, but let's start with a little bit of background. How long has the National Ability Center run programs in Moab, and what kinds of activities have historically been offered?
Yeah, absolutely. So the NAC technically was founded in 1985 up in Park City, but we came down to Moab in 2017. We merged with another nonprofit called Splore that had a similar mission, and we merged with them in 2017. So Splore was around for about 40 years before that, so they have a presence here in Moab, but NAC is getting their name out here down here.
And let's talk a little bit about what Splore traditionally did and what you're doing and how your initial operations in Moab began.
Yeah, absolutely. So we primarily run rafting trips down here in Moab. We have a really diverse permit pool, so we are able to run 7 different river stretches. And we run these stretches from 1 to 6 days with folks of all different abilities. And so we have a lot of the same groups coming with us year after year. We take them down Desolation Canyon or Ruby Horsey for Westwater Canyon or the Fisher Tower section. And we provide a service unlike other companies can do for folks with disabilities because of our training, because of our knowledge, because of our equipment.
And let's talk a little bit about that equipment. Let's talk about adaptive equipment in particular. Obviously, for some kinds of disabilities, special equipment is needed. Can you describe some of the range of things that you guys are able to do to facilitate the access to the water for people with different kinds of disabilities?
Yeah, definitely. So some of it is a little bit fancier than some other things. We really try to make it simpler. And so a couple things that we do on a lot of our rafting trips, we do have shade structures. They're called biminis, and they go in our boats and they shade the people that are riding in the boat. We do take them down for Class 3 and above rapids, but this enables us to be able to take folks who have potentially spinal cord injuries or are affected by the heat a lot more. We don't want people to get sunburned and get dehydrated, so the biminis are a great option for that. We have mats that we use at camp. They're called access mats, and they are a plastic mat that folds, and we can create a walkway or a pathway for folks using wheelchairs. We also have specialized wheelchairs like an X-Modus that has wheels on it that are similar to a beach wheelchair, so they can go over sand quite easily. Mm. And that enables us to help participants up from the boats when we have a steep sandy bank and their wheelchair wouldn't potentially go through the sand or over a rocky area. And then we have really simple things that we use that just work great. So our quote unquote adaptive chairs that we put on the boats are some heavy duty plastic lawn chairs that we cut the legs off of, and they have a high back and they sit on the boat, and we tie the chair down to the boat, and this enables people to have a sturdy backrest. They have arms on them, so it's a much more comfortable place for people to sit where they don't have to engage their core muscles to sit up or things like that. People love them. They call them the princess chairs. And I mean, everyone always is looking at us on the river like, oh, I want to ride in that boat. They have shade and they have a chair and everything. And then, I mean, it's the simplest of things. Sometimes it's, bringing along beach towels that we soak in the water and we put over participants if they have trouble regulating their internal temperature, things like that. It's just super simple for, getting people out in the water. So a little bit of tweaks here and there, learning about our participants, learning about who's coming and figuring out what's going to work best for them.
And, the National Ability Center has long been known for its great attention to safety. Talk a little bit about, I'm visualizing someone who is in a wheelchair or doesn't have sort of full use of arms and legs. How do you sort of protect them from, you know, if they get dumped in the water? I mean, a traditional life jacket probably needs something beyond that.
Yeah, this is my favorite topic. Thank you so much for asking. Risk management is like my thing. I absolutely love it. So if we have someone who might not have the best swimming ability or might be uncomfortable with someone falling into the water, we would certainly pair maybe a caregiver that came with them or a friend that came with them or one of our volunteers with that person to ensure, you know, to help give them stability in the boat and everything. We can't tell people that they're never, ever going to fall out of the boat, but certainly for some of our sections, it's a lot more mellow. There's not a big chance of people falling out. And then for some of our bigger sections, we just warn people. We let them know what we're getting in, what they're getting into. We screen people who are coming. We have a more in-depth conversation with them. And then I teach river rescue. So I teach safety for rivers through the American Canoe Association, and I've been doing that for 7 years. And I teach all of our guides and get them certified. And I specifically, one of the things I focus on is folks who might not be able to swim in the river. And so we specifically focus on jumping out of the raft or jumping off of the bank and going after someone and grabbing them and swimming them and bringing them back to the boat.
Okay, so I know that you're expanding operations in Moab. Can you sort of talk about what's going on there?
Yeah, it's exciting. We operate on Cermak Street. We are small, small organization compared to what we have going on up north. There's about 8 full-time of us, 2 managers, and about 6 full-time guides, and about 8 part-time guides. And right now we operate 95% on the river. And so we run, like I said, we have the potential to run about 7 different river stretches. We run 60 trips a year, and that's over 130 days in the summer. So we are quite busy. And we get about 1,700 user days on the river. So that's people times day they're on the river. And we, in 2019, we were able to purchase a property that sits above us right now, and it's 7 acres. 2 of those acres are buildable, and we are planning on building a fully accessible, affordable overnight accommodations for participants who are doing activities with the National Ability Center. We are extremely excited about it.
Okay, well, you also have some employee housing there as well?
Yeah, we do. We have a guidehouse, and right now we have a fantastic, amazing partnership with Colin Fryer, and he is just a wonderful donor of ours, and he owns the property. He helped us build our boathouse, and he had the guidehouse in which he lets us stay in it. And so, Colin, we have a guidehouse that 6 of our guides stay in right now, and so the plan moving forward is going to be to revise the guidehouse, to keep the boathouse, and to get some participant affordable and accessible lodging as well.
And do you have any plans to sort of expand the kind of programming you do? Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, we definitely do. Right now, we kind of need to rise to the level of what we're already doing. We do a lot with what we have. But yeah, absolutely. We want to bring more accessible adventures to Moab for folks of all different abilities. And so we do have different permits that we would be looking to utilize in the future. We have mountain bike permits that has been asked about a lot, when we are going to get more mountain biking here in Moab. Right now we do about a trip or two in the spring and a trip or two in the fall. And then we have canyoneering permits as well. And so with building, with getting more donors, and with getting, you know, more equipment and things like that, we're really excited to extend both our season and the amount of people that we can serve down here in Moab. We'll probably end up doing the mountain biking and the canyoneering in the spring and in the fall, and focus primarily on rafting in the summer.
Karen Locke, it sounds like you've got a lot to do today, like every other day. And we don't want to keep you off the river too much longer. So thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, wildfires remain a real concern in the Wasatch Bay and elsewhere around the country. Saturday, a group of HOAs will hold a wildfire preparedness fair. Here to talk about it is Angie Kell of the Glenwild HOA. Morning, Angie.
Good morning.
Angie, thanks for joining us this morning. Let's talk about this fair. What's the agenda for it and who organized it?
Yeah, great questions, and thanks for the opportunity to highlight this fair. So we have a whole litany of experts attending this fair and offering themselves as resources for homeowners within the participating HOAs. So we have representatives from the Park City Fire Department coming, as well as homeowners insurance consultants, because we know that's becoming more of an issue within Park City, as well as landscape design experts and in every aspect you could possibly imagine that's involved within wildfire mitigation will be in attendance. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that most of these folks are local and they're invested in our community and they've been phenomenal partners in this. And as far as why or how this all came to fruition is I think pretty much every Park City resident understands that we have wildfire risk. It only takes a short memory to last summer with the Yellow Lake fire to know that that's so. And so our community, Glenwild, has been increasing activity level as far as understanding what our individual wildfire risks are and encouraging our homeowners to take small steps to help mitigate that risk. We knew that neighborhoods such as the Colony and Pine Brook have really been at the forefront of mitigation efforts within their communities. And we reached out to them and they've been so helpful with their resources, sharing their resources, helping us understand how to conduct a fair to maximize impact. So that leads us to where we are today.
And can you explain a bit more about the format? What's going to happen if I walk up to the fair?
Yeah, great question. So first and foremost, the fair is occurring at Pine Brook Park. It begins at 10 a.m. And we'll allow a couple minutes for mingling and just getting familiar with the landscape. You will see vendors with tables where our experts will be residing. But shortly after the start of the fair, we will be featuring four speakers. We have four experts that are just going to do a short 5 to 10 minute debrief on various topics. So, for example, we have Johnny Coca from the Park City Fire Department. He's going to talk for a couple minutes on home hardening. What can homeowners do to help mitigate risks to their homes? We have Steve Davis, who is an insurance consultant, has his own business, and he's going to speak about a few things that homeowners insurance look for as far as mitigating risk. Then we have Catherine McMullen from the Summit County Emergency Management Department that's going to speak. And lastly, local Pine Brook resident Brad Washa from Utah Valley University will speak on a topic of his choosing as well.
Now, we've had Steve Davis on this program before. He's extremely knowledgeable. And obviously, one of the things that's driving all of this, a lot of this interest in the HOA community, is what's going on with homeowners insurance. Have you seen, and the other HOAs, are we starting to see sort of lack of coverage opportunities?
Great question. We are seeing a little bit of it. We recently surveyed our homeowners within Glenwild, and we are seeing a few insurance companies that are simply not covering Park City or Utah anymore. We are also seeing some premium increases. But lastly, we're also seeing some insurance companies wanting to come to the individual homes to assess what various mitigation efforts homeowners have done. And if they haven't done some, they will request those to be performed. So we're trying to be at the forefront of that. Keep ahead of it so that homeowners can retain their coverage.
And one of the things I've read, and not so much in this area, but it certainly to some extent in this area and some extent in other areas, is that the cost of homeowners insurance has driven HOAs to have kinds of restrictions that traditionally they never did have. I mean, historically you'd see architectural restrictions, some landscaping restrictions, but now you're seeing some HOAs moving to areas like you can't have wooden mulch within 5 feet of your property. Are those the kinds of things that you think people are actively discussing here in Summit and Wasatch counties as well?
That's a great question. I think, yes, the short answer is yes. Within Glen Wild, we have not made those mandates, but we are moving towards strongly encouraging homeowners to be assessing what is immediately around their home, including landscaping, the types of trees that they plant, and just choosing materials both within their landscape and within their home construction itself that might help abate fire risk.
And again, I don't want to put you on the spot because you may not be the expert, but let's talk a little bit about some of the other home hardening kinds of actions that are being discussed as ways of sort of mitigating wildfire risk.
Sure. And I am not an expert. I appreciate you saying that. But what we found is there is no shortage of website links to help you understand what those efforts are. And frankly, it gets overwhelming. So one thing we're doing within Glen Wild is we're trying to curate that list so that it's a little more actionable and it doesn't seem so overwhelming. So some of the easy things you mentioned about having mulch or wood chips immediately surrounding your home, you would consider putting in rock or something of that nature. Obviously, removing dead leaves, dry needles, other debris from your roof and your gutters and around the foundation can be really helpful. Pruning some of your larger trees is incredibly helpful. And really just creating a nice buffer zone and removing some vegetation that are directly interfacing with your home. I mean, those are some really simple steps a homeowner could take that just will help incredibly.
Okay. Let's once again go back to the logistics and the details of what people can expect tomorrow. And who are you recommending attend the fair?
Great. Yeah, so the Wildfire Preparedness Fair is sponsored by 7 local HOAs, and I'll just list them. Glen Wild, of course, Pinebrook, we have the Colony, we have all of the 8 HOAs from Jeremy Ranch, the Preserve, Quarry Mountain Ranch, and Stagecoach Estates. So we've extended the invitation to the homes residing within those HOAs. Having said that, if someone resides outside those HOAs and really wants to learn from this incredible roster of experts, we would not turn anyone away, but strongly encourage board members from other HOAs or participants on wildfire mitigation committees, we would strongly encourage them to attend as well.
Angie Kell of the Glen Wild HOA, thanks for spending time educating our listeners about the upcoming Wildfire Preparedness Fair.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Deer Valley Resort's second annual Mountain Pride Day returns to Snow Park Plaza on June 29th. In addition to Deer Valley's summer hiking, biking, and chairlift rides, this celebration includes outdoor yoga, live music, and opportunity drawings. Free yoga at the Snow Park Outdoor Amphitheater begins at 10:30 a.m. Participants must bring their own yoga mat. A group pride ride from the top of the Homestake Express chairlift takes off at 1 p.m. All proceeds and a portion of weekend ticket sales will benefit the nonprofit Summit Pride this year. Deer Valley is a financial supporter of KPCW. The Summit County Department of Communications and Public Engagement has created a WhatsApp channel for Spanish speakers. KPCW's Jonas Wright reports it's to better communicate public safety and health information.
The department created the WhatsApp channel titled Condado de Summit, Utah, specifically for the Spanish-speaking community. Communication specialist Bailey Quinn said many Spanish speakers already use WhatsApp to connect with family and friends, so the county created the channel to meet people where they already communicate. During the Parley's Canyon fire in 2021, evacuation messages were only sent in English, endangering Spanish-speaking residents in Timberline and Pinebrook. Quinn said that's when the county realized it was leaving the Spanish-speaking community at risk, especially during emergencies. It launched the Condado de Summit, Utah WhatsApp channel last summer.
The channel has grown to about 300 followers since we launched in August, but that's really not representative of our significant number of Spanish speakers in our area. And we'd love to see that number increase and help everyone in our community stay informed no matter what language they speak.
The Summit County Health Department one-way communication channel keeps followers anonymous, protecting their identities. The channel shares public health alerts, general news, and events in the area from county departments and community partners. For example, it shared evacuation alerts during the Main Street gas leak in Old Town June 10th. Daniela Moscoso has worked as a Latino outreach coordinator at the Summit County Health Department for 4 months. Moscoso said her previous job with the Park City School District showed her the Spanish-speaking community is always looking for ways to stay informed.
They would always express to me that they want to be a part of all the events. They want to know all the information going on in our county, in our city, but they don't always have the tools and the information available.
Quinn said she and Moscoso are working on a series of behavioral and mental health resource posts to share this summer. Learn more about Condado de Summit Utah WhatsApp channel at kpcw.org. Escucha esta historia en español en kpcw.org para en español. Jonas Wright, KPCW News.
Well, some Park City roads will close for maintenance and events next week, which will also affect bus routes. Thanes Canyon Drive closes for construction Monday and Tuesday. That'll reroute Park City Transit buses, including the 2 Green and 3 Blue, over to Payday Drive. Wednesday construction will move to 3 Kings Drive. That will cause the bus lines to be rerouted over to Park Avenue. That road will open on June 28th. And Main Street will close to vehicles from Heber Avenue to Sweet Alley next week for road work. Crews will close the road from 2 a.m. to 2 p.m. to apply a slurry seal, protecting the pavement and improving surface quality. Main Street will close again Thursday at 10 a.m. for Savor the Summit. It'll reopen around midnight after the event concludes. These road closures will not affect pedestrian access. And once again, Old Town parking is free until June 30th, except during special events like Park City Market. Summit County residents, start your engines. You have until the end of the month to register for Camas Fiesta Day's newest event, lawnmower racing. KPCW's Connor Thomas has details.
Robbie Brimhall of Camas says his late father remembers the city's annual fair used to include drag races on Center Street. Now he's organizing a fun-sized version of that, lawnmower racing. This is the first year the event will feature at Fiesta Days. The city's starting by holding an oval loop race during halftime at the Demolition Derby. It's something Brimhall says he's got some experience with.
One of my chores was to mow the grass in the summertime. And I would get on the lawnmower, and I always like to go fast with this type of stuff. I had a go-kart, you know, and all that, you know, as most kids did grew up. And I'd get on the lawnmower, and when Dad wouldn't be watching, I'd go ahead and put it in the highest gear that it could go and circle around the yard.
Until the belt broke, that is. Luckily, Brimhall's father was a mechanic by trade, and he's passed those skills down to his son. The younger Brimhall hopes to expand the race in the future, potentially introducing drag racing and extreme modifications. For now, there are two oval races, 5-lap stock and 10-lap modified. The stock race is aimed at kids. Regular riding lawnmowers don't go faster than 5 to 8 miles per hour. When they're modified, it's a different story.
There's one that I've seen do about 55, 60 miles an hour.
Modifications usually include a souped-up engine, but also powertrain parts that can handle the new motor. There are 8 spots available in each race, and registration is free. Race winners get $300, second place $150, and $50 for third.
And I wanted to bring something fun and new to the valley to give back.
Even stock lawnmowers have to be modified slightly for safety, including removing the actual mowing blades. There is more information on Camas's website. Registration closes July 1st. Fiesta Days are from July 19th to the 26th. Other activities include the rodeo, basketball tournament, mutton bustin', power wheels, parade, and pickleball. The Demolition Derby is opening night. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, I for one think that Connor Thomas could do a better job of covering the event if he were to enter, but we'll see if that actually happens. Okay, for the first time in its history, Trailside Elementary is getting a mascot, an elk. And as KPCW's Christine Weller reports, the choice is a nod to the animals who often graze on campus grounds.
Trailside opened in 2001, but no official mascot or school colors were adopted.
We've never had official colors, so people just choose colors, and so there was nothing ever consistent. And so really trying to create, you know, a consistent logo, something we can be tied to.
That's Principal Tracy Fike. Now, almost 25 years later, the school is adopting the elk as its mascot and red, white, and black as its colors. Fike said the elk was recommended as the mascot because it's a familiar presence in the community. Many mornings consist of chasing elk off the trailside playground.
We've become good elk herders. It's really actually fun when you're over there at recess and you look up and you can see them spotted on the hill. They just chill right behind us. So we thought that would be just a nice tie for our students.
Trailblazer used to be the unofficial mascot, and Fike said the elk exemplifies a trailblazing spirit, strong, courageous, and adventurous. Red, white, and black were chosen as the colors as they align with color schemes used by other schools in the district and have been used as the unofficial trailside school colors. The Board of Education unanimously approved the proposal at its June 17th meeting. To foster school spirit, students will be involved in a school-wide naming contest for the elk mascot. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up right after NPR News, we have the Community Campfire this week. You can learn about Sycamore Swing, a teen-led weekly dance night in Heber Valley that blends country fun and community connection with beginner swing lessons, line dancing, and all-ages charm for just $8. Our Campfire Music Sesh will feature Crooked Kings. They're an indie rock band out of Salt Lake City that is on the rise. Plus, of course, we will have Coach Skinner's local sports, community events, fun facts, and you never know what our Campfire kids will say next. That's coming up right after the NPR News. And Monday on Mountain Money, we're going to have Shelby Stame. She's the owner of Stretch Lab, a new outlet at the Kimball Junction. Then we'll talk to Dendrick Labs, Dendrick Estates, and Jen Silver of Roofing Utah. All this and more Mountain Money.